engage in coalition, in litigation, in agitation. That's what we do. We do it every day all across the country in small towns and big cities. And we run into incidents like this Philadelphia thing.
Julian Bond speaking in 2009. He died on August 15th, 2015, just a few days ago. That does it for our show. Thanks to Eleanor Holmes Norton and to Taylor Branch, to Richard Cohen and to Ben Jealous. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke and Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Noreen Shake. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org.
Looking for a career? KBOO is proud to be a co-sponsor of Oregon's 15th Annual Diversity Employment Day Career Fair. The fair will be held Wednesday, August 26th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Ambridge Events Center, located at 1333 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. Participants may interview with over 50 major employers who are recruiting for hundreds of positions. The career fair is sponsored by the DiversityRecruitersNetwork.org. Business attire is required and bring plenty of resumes. More information is available at citycareerfair.com or on the right-hand side of the KBOO homepage at kboo.fm.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the 4th Portland Renters Assembly and their March for Housing Rights. The assembly is on August 26th at the Midland Library from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. There will be speakers on the housing crisis and community organizing, personal stories, large and small group discussion about political strategy, but also defending and otherwise supporting each other. Snacks and childcare will be provided. The march is on August 28th. It starts at City Hall at 6 p.m. with a rally and ends at the Multnomah County Building with another assembly. The theme will be Housing Rights for All and will encompass everything from homelessness to affordable housing to tenants' rights to at-cost public housing. More information can be found at kboo.fm under Community Events or portlandrentersassembly.info.
You gotta fight for your right!
The time is 5:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next on KBOO, it's the evening news.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub. Independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, civil rights leader Julian Bonds has died.
The Independent Party of Oregon has qualified as the third major party in the state.
And the increasing number of wildfires in Oregon is threatening to blow out funds allotted to fight the fires.
Good evening. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 17, 2015. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Oregon City's city manager was placed on administrative leave late last week, and a former Oregon Supreme Court justice was hired to conduct an investigation. Oregon City commissioners declined to state why City Manager David Frasher was placed on administrative leave, but indicated the matter was non-criminal in nature. Community Development Director Tony Conkle was appointed interim city manager.
The Independent Party of Oregon has qualified as the third major political party in the state. Secretary of State Jean Atkins announced the news today, which means the party will be able to participate in the state finance primary election in May 2016. The Independent Party will no longer have to pay for its own primary elections, which it held previously over the internet. The timing of the certification still presents some problems for the party, which has less than a month to find candidates willing to run for office under its affiliation. The party certification is a result of its increased membership of registered voters, which now exceeds the threshold of 5% of all voters in the 2014 election. Currently, the Independent Party claims over 109,000 members compared to 644,000 for Republicans in the state and 815,000 for Democrats.
A number of cities around the country, including Seattle, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, are raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour in the coming years. However, for much of the country, hourly wages have stagnated, which results in incomes well below the poverty line. With the impact of raising the federal minimum drastically from $7.25 in mind, over 200 economists around the country have signed a letter in support of a $15 minimum wage. 10 of those economists work in Oregon, and 3 of them will be speaking at a rally tomorrow in Portland. Jamie Partridge, the chief petitioner for the Oregon ballot initiative to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, spoke with KBOO's Eric Tegedoff about the rally and the possible effects of the raise.
Actually, if you could just explain the letter a bit to us first.
Explain the letter?
Yeah, if you could just say a little bit about
it. It's in support of a bill before the U.S. Congress establishing a $15 minimum wage by 2020. And as it stated in the letter signed by over 200 economists, if wages had kept up with U.S. labor productivity since 1968, federal minimum wage would be $26 an hour. So what we've seen happen is that the money produced, or excuse me, the wealth produced by low-wage workers has gone to the 1% and not to the workers themselves. And in fact, in Oregon, we've seen the share of income flowing to the highest 1% is now double the income of the bottom 40% combined. And just 30 years ago, the top 1% had significantly less than the bottom 40%. And so there's a real turnaround in where the money's going, and it's certainly not being shared equitably. And raising the minimum wage would do a lot for creating greater equality.
I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the event that's being held tomorrow.
Well, tomorrow we have economists who support a $15 minimum wage speaking about why they signed on to a letter in support of a national federal minimum wage of $15, actually in support of a bill that's been introduced in the Congress last month for $15 minimum wage. Over 200 economists, including 10 from Oregon, and you'll have 3 of those people speaking at Portland State University tomorrow morning.
A lot of people have a concern that raising the minimum wage will actually cause some businesses to cut jobs, and what your response to that is.
Well, actually, in all the studies, there's shown to be a negligible impact on employment, and in fact, usually the overall economy is benefits because more people have money in their pocket to spend, and low-wage workers spend their money locally, so that businesses who are worried about being able to afford to pay their workers $15 minimum wage need to take into account that there are going to be more customers with more money in their pocket, so there'll be an increase in their business. Plus, there are added benefits of having a higher wage for a workforce, which means lower turnover, which means less cost for training, happier workers, better productivity.
Why do you think so many economists have signed on to this proposal?
Because the minimum wage has truly stagnated in this country. The federal minimum wage hit its peak in 1968 at the equivalent of about $11 an hour now in 2015 wages. And although we feel good about having a minimum wage of $9.25 in Oregon, it's still only 84% of the real value of the federal minimum wage 50 years ago. And we're worse off because of it. you know, we suffer more inequality, more poverty, more homelessness. There's a bigger gap between women and men, between people of color and whites. There's worse health, less economic mobility, more despair than we had back in 1968. And the overall impact of raising the minimum wage will be a more robust economy, and economists understand that and are therefore supporting it.
Do you know how the wage increase has affected some of the cities that have already adopted the plan, like Seattle and Los Angeles?
Well, yes, in Seattle, Los Angeles, San Francisco, where they're starting to raise the minimum wage up to 15 over a few years, there have been reports of more businesses being created, of more employment being created, and studies have shown in places like San Jose, where in 2013 they raised the minimum wage by $2 in 1 year, their number of businesses that failed went down, and actually the number of businesses that were created went up.
For KBOO News, this is Eric Tegedoff. I've been speaking with the chief petitioner for the $15 minimum wage ballot initiative, Jamie Partridge.
In 2003, Springfield, Oregon police officials hired Thelma Barone as a crime prevention practitioner to help build ties with the Latino community, a post she held until she was fired last Wednesday. She claimed she was fired after responding to an audience question at the City Club of Springfield back in February about whether she had, during her work with the Latino community, ever heard complaints about racial profiling. She said yes, she had, and claims to have taken regular phone calls from Latinos in 2013 alleging they had been racially profiled by the police. A week after that event, she was escorted out of the police department and placed under administrative leave for what her superiors claimed was dishonest conduct. This claim concerned whether she had gotten permission a year ago to allow high school students to take photos during a police department tour, though she says that in reality it was an attempt to retaliate against her for the comments made at the City Club a week earlier. Barone was told she would be fired, but after the police union became involved, she was instead allowed to return after a one-month suspension. When Barone came back to work, the police department had reassigned her from her multicultural engagement position to a community service on patrol. Finally, the police administration offered her a last chance agreement prohibiting her from saying anything negative about the city and its employees, including her police colleagues. She refused to sign it on August 9th and was fired a few days later. Barone has since filed a federal lawsuit against the Springfield Police Department, the city, and several city officials.
A final vote on decommissioning the Mount Tabor water reservoirs is scheduled for Wednesday at 11 a.m. The Portland City Council is set to approve a $7.4 million plan to decommission the historic water reservoirs, despite widespread public disagreement over the plan. The decommissioning process involves removing dozens of trees, in addition to excavation in 11 different areas of the park. The City Council has stated the actions are required by new EPA rules intended to safeguard against waterborne illnesses. Opponents of the plan believe the reservoirs are safe and are considering filing a legal challenge with the State Land Use Board of Appeals.
The Beaverton City Council votes tomorrow on an appeal to protect 2.5 acres of wetlands near a new high school in the South Cooper Mountain area. The Beaverton School District plans to build a number of athletic fields for the new high school on the wetlands. Last month, the school district's plan was approved by a narrow vote of the Beaverton Planning Commission. Tualatin Riverkeepers, an environmental advocacy group, is appealing that approval, and the appeal will be discussed and decided on at Tuesday's City Council meeting. For more information, KBOO's Ken Jones spoke with Brian Wegener of Tualatin Riverkeepers.
Brian, last month the Beaverton Planning Commission approved a conditional use permit which allows the athletic fields to be built for the new South Cooper Mountain High School on 2.5 acres of wetlands. Your organization, the Tualatin Riverkeepers, is appealing this decision. First, where are the wetlands located in relation to the high school?
The wetlands are on the north end of the high school property. This high school property is located on 175th and Shoals Ferry, newly annexed into Beaverton.
What's the potential damage if the athletic fields are built on the wetlands?
There's a wetland existing there that's about 8 or 9 acres, I believe, and about 3 acres of that are on the high school property. So they would take out 2.5 acres of that wetland and reduce the size, the overall size of the wetland by 2.5 acres. And the Cooper Mountain Plan has identified this wetland as the highest priority for preservation. And so it appears that the Planning Commission disregarded the Cooper Mountain Plan that was approved by the City Council back in February.
And the commission I have here actually voted 4-2 to approve the permit. There's 7 commissioners, but one was absent from the vote. So this was not a unanimous decision by any means. It was fairly close.
That's correct. And the commissioner who wasn't there also stated the week before that she would have voted against it if she could be there. So by 4-3, they lost this decision, but several of the commissioners stated clearly that the reason they were voting against it was the filling of the wetlands was contrary to the Cooper Mountain Plan, and it was avoidable. We have suggested to the school district and to the city that there are alternative sites for those athletic fields. In fact, the Cooper Mountain Plan identified 3 sites within walking distance of the high school that are suitable for parks and school facilities. They're level, they're dry, and they're within walking distance of the school. Additionally, property adjacent to the school, to the west of the school, owned by Ed Bartholomew, is already zoned for those type of facilities and wouldn't need a conditional use permit to get athletic fields built on that. So we've identified those 4 alternatives to filling in the wetland. And there are other alternatives of scheduling your fields differently if you really wanted to avoid filling a wetland.
Why is the Beaverton School District so set on building on the wetlands then? And again, it's not all the athletic fields. It's kind of a subset of them.
Yeah, it's definitely a subset of the athletic fields. It appears to me that they drew up their plan in isolation from everybody else. They weren't at the Cooper Mountain Citizen Advisory Committee meetings. I asked where they were many times over that 2-year period. They just did their plan in isolation and just basically want to roll ahead with that without any interruption. And that's not the government. That's not good citizenship. And it's disregarding what the community put together for the best use of that site.
It's been reported, and I read that the Beaverton Schools superintendent said the district wasn't even aware that the property contained wetlands when it was purchased. And apparently, according to him at least, these wetlands near the high school were not on any wetland maps of the area. Is that true?
Because nobody had slated that area for development, they hadn't done a wetland delineation. And so it's amazing that the school district spent millions of dollars to acquire the site without doing the due diligence to identify wetlands before they purchased the price. And this was pointed out by a couple of the planning commissioners that this was just pure negligence on the part of the school district that they didn't do that analysis before they purchased the site.
Yeah, that does sound odd. I also want to let our listeners know, Brian, and you've emphasized this before in articles and previous interviews, that the Tualatin Riverkeeper's appeal will not delay actual construction on the high school itself, just, again, this subset of athletic fields?
Right. They've already started moving earth, but they're staying out of the wetland area. They got preliminary grading approval to remove, I believe it was 338 trees out of the 341 trees on the site because they were in their way.
The city council meeting, Beaverton City Council meeting, is tomorrow, and they'll hear your appeal and apparently decide on it, I guess, tomorrow. If they decide against it, the plan actually still needs further approval, right from the Oregon Division of State Lands and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers?
That is correct. They need approvals from all 3, state, local, and federal approvals.
Oh, so my question is, why appeal now to the Beaverton City Council rather than kind of this next step down the line to the Army Corps of Engineers and the Division of State Lands?
Well, we have a lot invested in the Cooper Mountain Plan. I went to meetings for almost 2 years, and there's other natural resource protections in that plan, and no local jurisdiction should be able to disregard their community plans that they went through. We fear that this would set a precedent that they could fill in this wetland, then they could start destroying other natural resources that are protected by their community plan.
The city council, again, they'll hear the appeal tomorrow and decide on it.
I'm not asking you to predict the future, but do you have any idea which way the city council is leaning?
I don't. My thought is that the city council back in February approved the Cooper Mountain plan, so we know they invested in that, and they approved the plan that said these wetlands have the highest preservation priority. So my thought is that they would uphold their own plan that they approved.
For our cable listeners who would like to voice an opinion on the issue, what can they do? Show up at the city council meeting tomorrow?
Right. The city council meeting is at 6:30 tomorrow at the Beaverton building near the Round. They can also go to the city of Beaverton's website and send an email to the city council stating their thoughts on this wetland.
We've been talking with Brian Wegener, advocacy manager and riverkeeper for Tualatin Riverkeepers. This is Ken Jones with KBOO News.
The increasing number of wildfires in Oregon and neighboring states is threatening to wipe out the allowed budget. Wildfires in Idaho and Washington state are requiring additional manpower and equipment such as helicopters and bulldozers. As funds run out, the National Guard and military personnel have been called in to help. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said that Congress needs to approve using additional funding dollars to help pay for the manpower and equipment needed for battling these wildfires. Another condition that's making the wildfires more dangerous to fight is climate change, which is causing storms to be more violent. So far this year, there have been 790 fires with nearly 30,000 acres burned.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for the Union Edge. This will be followed by Labor Radio at 6. At 6:30, we'll hear about the In Deportations and Detentions Now movement in Portland on Prison Pipeline. At 7, it's the River Signal with KBOO's Aaron Yankee. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny and hot. The high is 99 and the low is 64. Today in history, the last day of the Woodstock Music Festival took place. In 1962, East German Border Patrol shot Peter Frechter as he attempted to try to escape over the Berlin Wall into West Germany. Frechter lay dying and screaming in pain, but no one came to his aid. West German border guards could not help because he was in East German territory. The quote of the day is from Julian Bond, who we hope is resting in peace. Violence is black children going to school for 12 years and receiving 6 years worth of education.
It's 5:23. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
If you think that none of today's presidential candidates care about people like you, check out Republican Scott Walker. The Wisconsin governor not only cares, he wants to sit down with you, get your ideas, and stay in close touch. No matter who you are, Scotty wants you to join his team so his presidency can be your presidency. Not a Republican? No problemo, amigo. Walker doesn't check your papers. Well, except for that $1 million check you have to write to his super PAC. That's the ticket price for entering Walker's Inner Circle, where you can discuss your policy concerns and seek personal favors straight from your lips to the candidate's ear. Even if you're a common working stiff, just give $1 million and you're in. Is this a great country or what? Maybe you're wondering what specifically your money buys. Well, Scott's Super PAC even prints out a handy purchasing slip showing that you'll be, quote, an executive board member of the Walkerites campaign. Thus, you'll have two private dinners with the man, a Walker staffer dedicated to your needs, special briefings and weekly emails, bi-monthly conference calls, biannual retreats, and best of all, quote, an exclusive executive board pin. Golly, I haven't been this excited or felt so included since the 1950s when I became a member of the Mickey Mouse Club and got my own set of mouse ears. This is Jim Hightower saying, when the Supreme Court descended into the Alice in Wonderland fantasy that corporations are people and money is speech, it was inevitable that American politics would devolve to a frivolous game that shuts out the workaday majority and enthrones a Koch brothers plutocracy sustained by secret money super PACs and whorish candidates like Walker. To help end this corrupt mockery of our electoral democracy, go to democracyisforpeople.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Civil rights leader and icon Julian Bond died over the weekend at the age of 75 from a brief illness. Bond was well known in the 60s as an organizer with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and participated crucially in the historic sit-in movement. He served in the Georgia legislature for 20 years, was the board president for the Southern Poverty Law Center from 1971 to 1979, and was chair of the NAACP from 1998 to 2008. He's well remembered for the Supreme Court case Bond versus Floyd, during which he won his right to a seat in the Georgia legislature after expressing criticism of the Vietnam War. This landmark case confirmed that while the state has an interest in compelling its legislators to swear an oath that they should believe in the constitutional processes of government, it cannot bar them from expressing their views on national or state issues, for that would be a violation of their constitutionally protected freedom of speech. He later went on to become an outspoken critic of the Iraq War and was one of the few black civil rights leaders to speak out on marriage equality for gay and lesbian people.
A pharmacist who has been examining the drug records of a Cleveland woman who was found dead in her jail cell, 37-year-old Rakina Jones, was jailed on July 24th after a fight with her ex-husband outside a bar. Two days later, she was dead, possibly from having her drugs administered incorrectly by the jail. There are discrepancies between her prisoner log and the jail log. A pharmacist has been checking these records, saying that if some of the drugs were issued in excess, they could have been a cause for death. Rakina Jones's death comes shortly after the death of Sandra Bland, another jailed black woman, this time in Texas.
Over the weekend, the New York Times published an exposé on the e-commerce website Amazon.com. In the article, the Times interviewed over 100 past and current employees of the huge internet company. The employees describe a workplace in which managers attempt to weed out employees by bullying or backstabbing other employees. Employees were also asked to work late into the night via email, and when emails were not responded to, the employees would receive a text asking why they had not responded. Bo Olson, who formerly worked in Amazon's book marketings, said, quote, "Nearly every person I worked with, I saw cry at their desk," unquote. CEO Jeff Bezos refutes the article's claims, though he admits interviewing over 100 employees makes the article less than anecdotal. Amazon is currently adding to their headquarters in Seattle, and in about 3 years will have enough space for 50,000 employees.
And now, we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises.
For WIN, I'm Joanne Powers. Members of the United Steelworkers are picketing outside a dozen plants in six states after being locked out Saturday night by specialty steel manufacturer ATI. The lockout began after the union rejected the company's last best offer. The USW considers the offer's 105 worker concessions, including increased health care costs for workers and severe reductions in pension and retiree medical benefits for new hires, to be unreasonable demands. Bill Campbell is the grievance representative for USW Local 1196 in Brackenridge, Pennsylvania, where ATI just built a new $1.2 billion hot rolling mill.
In a week's time, they could do a month's worth of work compared to the old plant. That's a heck of a cost savings. The union, time and time again, has bent over and tried to help them. We've done whatever it takes to keep the place profitable. They're just being very unreasonable and unfair to the workers here right now. They're giving out these humongous bonuses to their upper management. How can you tell us you're making no money and you're throwing these bonuses around, you know, just like throwing sand in our eyes?
The workers are expecting a long, difficult fight, but have vowed to stand their ground.
They're out trying to break the unions right now, and we got to stand tall. We are still willing to bargain. We're here to try to get a contract that's fair and equitable for both parties.
On Friday, the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, representing 700,000 workers, have announced their endorsement of Hillary Clinton for the 2016 presidential election, becoming the second union to endorse the Democratic frontrunner after the American Federation of Teachers. Her main primary opponent, Senator Bernie Sanders, has been narrowing her lead, winning the endorsement last Monday of the nation's largest nurses union, National Nurses United. IAM leadership endorsed Clinton when she overwhelmingly defeated Sanders in a poll of their rank-and-file members. With the WIN News Analysis, here's Frank Emsbeck.
The fight for 15 and a union is encompassing ever greater areas of the economy. It's increasingly clear that low wages are not tied only to educational attainment. Every skill level is affected. Adjunct professors, many with PhDs, are paid considerably less than $15 an hour. Many make less than $25,000 for a year's work. Home health aides, childcare workers, fast food workers, and salespeople all make on the average less than $15 per hour. In many cases, family deprivation caused by low wages is made worse by the on-call schedule method of scheduling. This means that firms call workers when they are needed. There is no fixed schedule. No schedule makes it almost impossible to have a reasonable family life and provide adequate care for young children. Thus, the fight for 15 impacts all areas of our society. To the extent that workers can unify and mobilize, the fight for 15 and a union may be the movement that transforms our society.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Connecticut's Supreme Court ruled last Thursday that the state could no longer impose the death penalty. The court found the death penalty accounted to cruel and unusual punishment and was therefore illegal under the state's constitution. Connecticut passed a law in 2012 that abolished capital punishment for crimes committed after April 25, 2012, but allowed it to be imposed for crimes committed before that date. All inmates currently on death row in Connecticut will have their sentences converted to life in prison without possibility of release.
An historic South Carolina Baptist church has officially accepted the LGBT community in all aspects of the congregation. The First Baptist Church of Greenville approved a consensus statement that accepts the LGBT community in not just the congregation, but in leadership, marriage, baptism, teaching, and ordination, saying they will not discriminate based on sexual orientation or gender identity. First Baptists of Greenville disassociated themselves from the Southern Baptist Convention in 1999, which does not allow same-sex marriage. Now they're affiliated with the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, which allows individual churches to decide for themselves.
Japan has restarted a nuclear power plant for the first time since the 2008 earthquake and tsunami caused multiple meltdowns at Fukushima. The Sendai power plant in southwestern Japan was restarted last week, even though polls show that a majority of Japanese citizens do not believe nuclear power is safe. On Saturday, the Japanese Weather Agency issued a high alert for a major eruption at a nearby volcano only 30 miles from the restarted nuclear power plant. Authorities issued the warning for Mount Tsukurajima as the seismic activity increased to over 1,100 tremors on Saturday alone. If a large-scale eruption did occur, up to 600,000 nearby citizens could be forced to evacuate, and roads to the Sendai nuclear power plant could become unpassable. Japan is currently building two new nuclear power plants, and nine more are in the planning stages.
12 countries are currently negotiating a trade agreement in secret called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. Included in this partnership are the United States and New Zealand. Many activists believe the agreement is far from a normal trade agreement and will negatively affect countries involved. On Saturday, protesters gathered in New Zealand to protest the trade agreement. FSRN's Carla Green has this report from the protests.
Thousands of protesters have poured into the streets across New Zealand, calling on their country to walk away from negotiations of the TPP. More than 2,000 people recently marched in the small New Zealand city of Dunedin, where activist Rob Stewart addressed the crowd.
We don't want this thing to go through. We're here as leaders of our community telling them, no way. Who's with me?
The TPP is highly controversial, not only because of the secrecy that surrounds it, but also because of leaked portions of the agreement that trade experts say could have serious negative implications for citizens of the signing countries. They've warned the TPP could affect everything from the price of medicine to copyright laws to state-owned enterprises like CBC or Radio New Zealand. Activist and social worker Jen Olsen organized the recent anti-TPP protest in Dunedin. She thinks New Zealanders are upset about the TPP for a lot of the same reasons people in other countries are, including its confidentiality.
A big one is, of course, the secrecy itself and the fact that once people find out that something as wide-ranging and important as the TPP is happening kind of under their noses but being hidden, that is something that concerns a lot of people and they want to find out more.
That very secrecy is at the core of a joint court case pending against the New Zealand government. Legal scholar Jane Kelsey is leading the legal action on behalf of seven organizations, including Consumer New Zealand, Oxfam, and Greenpeace. Back in January, she filed an official information request for a number of TPP-related documents, including the draft text itself. When Kelsey requested the documents, Trade Minister Tim Grosser refused to hand them over. So now the group is taking him to court. They filed the court papers on August 5th. Kelsey can't talk about the details of the legal case before it's heard by New Zealand's High Court, but she can say it's challenging the right of the New Zealand government to keep the TPP a secret.
We are questioning the interpretation that the minister has made of the powers to withhold documents under New Zealand's domestic legislation, irrespective of whatever they may have agreed to externally.
If the petitioners prevail and the TPP draft texts are released, it would be the ultimate victory in a years-long public education campaign about the trade agreement.
Once people understand what the issues are and how it affects them, then they have become vocal. And we've seen politicians also, including now the Labour Party, expressing their own concern. And so I think it's simply been a matter of education around something that is very obtuse.
Japanese opponents to the TPP have also launched their own constitutional challenge to the secrecy of the agreement. That legal action mirrors a spirited public engagement about the TPP that the Japanese and New Zealand public share.
My experience is that, in fact, the debates in New Zealand have been amongst the most vibrant, perhaps from Japan.
Kelsey thinks that vibrancy could, in large part, be explained simply.
New Zealand does not have a free trade agreement with the US, and nor does Japan. A number of the other countries, if you look at Chile or Peru, they already have FTAs with the US. So many of the more extreme demands that the US is making in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, especially in the non-trade areas such as intellectual property or investment, other countries have already made.
Olsen has also noticed the interest that the TPP has piqued in New Zealand, as evidenced by the recent week of widespread public actions and rallies. She attributes it, at least in part, to a deep and enduring skepticism of the national government.
I think that in New Zealand, if people get the idea that someone's trying to pull the wool over their eyes, they don't like it. And they're more and more likely to say, no, I want to know about that. I'm not going to let that go. They don't accept it. There's not so much conformity, perhaps. And I certainly think in the United States that there's a higher level of political conformity and a less of political discussion and information and understanding in the general community than there is here.
So be happy as you slave away, locked into your lowly wage, cause the TPP is good for...
When talks in Maui last month failed to reach a conclusion, New Zealand activists and even some industry opponents rejoiced. It bought them more time to convince the public of the ills of the TPP, Olsen says. And time is ticking. Canada has elections coming up in October, and the United States has its own roadshow of an election cycle rapidly approaching. Global trade analysts speculate that if Canada and the U.S. don't sign the TPP before their respective political changeovers, they never will. But New Zealand Prime Minister John Key insists New Zealand will be able to close the deal, and said negotiators were getting, quote, close to the final bits of the issues at hand. Further TPP negotiations are tentatively planned for later this month. Carla Green, FSRN, New Zealand.
John Key, champion of democracy. John Key, John Key.
Climate activists in Germany stormed the country's largest open-pit coal mine on Saturday, shutting down the operations of Europe's largest carbon emitter. Under a banner reading, "Here and no further," more than 1,000 protesters broke past police lines and climbed fences. They crossed miles of private land to stop the treads and excavation buckets of the world's heaviest industry vehicle, the Bagger 288. The machines are used at RWE's coal fields in the Rhineland to mine open-cast lignite, or brown coal, which is considered by environmentalists to be the number one climate killer worldwide. RWE owns four massive open-cast mines, amounting to roughly 2,500 square kilometers of land, making the company the largest single emitter of carbon pollution in the world. The machines, which have enormous rotating saw of buckets to cut into coal hills, can mine up to 240,000 tons of coal a day. The activists succeeded in climbing the treads of and sitting beneath three of the machines, effectively shutting those machines down for the day. Many of the protesters were arrested by police early on, but overall, the activists considered the action a huge success in that it has helped the public identify the most egregious carbon polluters.
Under President Evo Morales, Bolivia has gone from one of South America's poorest countries to the fastest growing economy on the continent. Much of that wealth has come from vast oil and gas reserves. But as global gas prices have dropped, Bolivia's economy has been threatened. Now, President Morales is opening Bolivia's environmentally protected areas to exploration. Environmental and indigenous groups in the country oppose the move. For more on the dispute, FSRN's Aldo Oriana Lopez filed this report.
Bolivia is home to a wealth of biological diversity and natural resources. The country's economy and its national budget relied heavily on tax revenue from the mining and gas sectors. In 2014 alone, oil and gas sales brought $6 billion into government coffers. In recent years, Bolivia has had one of the highest rates of economic growth in South America, but that economic stability is vulnerable to prices set in international markets. Jorge Campanini, a researcher with Bolivia's Center for Information and Documentation, says the slump in global oil and gas prices has the government looking to increase production.
The government relies on hydrocarbons revenue to fund its programs, and the need to count on those resources is causing the government to push forward with opening up protected areas in order to meet its obligations, especially when it comes to exports.
Campanini says this puts financial stability for the government against the environmental concerns and territorial control of indigenous communities in resource-rich areas. In recent months, the government has issued decrees authorizing oil and gas-related activities in seven of Bolivia's 22 protected ecological zones. To facilitate the process, the government also amended the legal process that requires informed consent from indigenous communities that may be affected by the development projects. Indigenous Guarani leader Celso Padilla is a member of the Assembly of Guarani People in Bolivia, which represent 50,000 people in approximately 250 communities.
The package of decrees bypassed the nation's constitution. For example, it restricts the rights to prior consultation and participation. This is why we're on the brink of an emergency.
momento en pie de emergencia.
The decrees reduced the consultation process to no more than 45 days and forced communities in affected areas to come to an agreement with energy companies about investment priorities. Padilla says this undercuts their negotiating position when it comes to fair compensation.
This has us very upset and worried because it will only increase damages like pollution and negatively impact us on all levels, the social, environmental, political, economic, cultural, and spiritual. This is why we're calling for a serious debate with the government.
Bolivia's state run oil and gas company, YPFB, has responded to criticism by insisting it will use advanced technology and non-invasive methods. The company adds it will operate in less than 1% of the territorial total of the 7 protected areas that the government wants to explore. President Evo Morales argues the ability to decide how to use the resources within the national territory is a matter of sovereignty. Sarela Paz, an expert on indigenous governance system and protected ecological zones, argues that reforming laws by presidential decree to facilitate oil and gas operations is the opposite of sovereignty.
We can't separate what the government is doing from a context in which energy companies are able to make demands of nation states. In many cases, countries deeply rely on these initiatives for revenue. So it's a relationship of dependence, not of sovereignty.
With the recent discovery of an estimated 28 million barrels of oil, Bolivia has tripled its projected hydrocarbon reserves. President Morales plans to continue developing those reserves during his term in office and has threatened to expel foreign NGOs that oppose those plans. Meanwhile, Celso Padilla of the Assembly of Guarani People says the government is attempting to divide Bolivia's Guarani community with the aim of weakening the opposition to new oil and gas projects. But opposition to drilling in protected areas has also galvanized Guaranis in other South American countries like Argentina, Paraguay and Brazil. Aldo Orellana López, FSRN, Cochabamba, Bolivia.
Newly reported information from the Edward Snowden files shows